Ich gehe zu Menachem David, für 15 Minuten weg. The last man spoke was 4 years ago, and I spoke about wills and inheritance in Halacha. And Menachem David asked me to do a part two. And it's taken a bit of a while, 4 years. But Mitzshem will discuss the Inyan again, with a little bit of Chazara, just a little bit of Chazara, and Mitzshem some Chidushim as well, Beit Hashem. So, I'm going to share with the Olam a Maisa Shaloi Haya. A lot of the elements are true, but the total story is complete fiction. But all of the parts have happened in some way or another, but the whole story is impossible. And I may think, probably all of you at some point will think, oh, that sounds familiar. These stories are always happening. So here's the Maisa. I get a call from an elderly woman a few years ago, and I go around there, and we're discussing.
And you get a call.
Yes, absolutely. And I go around there, and we start discussing what she wants to have written in her will. Right? And it seems that her estate is comprised of the following. She's got a house, she's got a couple of bank accounts, some other items, a car. And she's telling me what she wants to do with it. Fine. Then I mentioned to her, you know, when was your husband Nifta? So she says, my husband was Nifta 5 years ago. Fine. All sounds good so far. I said, just to confirm, is the house yours? You're talking about, you know, your house is clearly your most significant asset. Is the house yours? You're saying you want to give it to your children alone, that's like, is it yours?
Didn't get the job.
So she says, yeah, sure,
it's the airport, the station.
I said, okay.
Too expensive.
How is the house yours? So she says, well, my husband used to own the house. She says, my husband used to own the house. And now it's mine. Well, did your husband write a will? No, he didn't write a will. But it's mine. I'm living in it. Who else is living in it? I've had it, it's mine. Okay, so then that's another question. Who did it used to belong to? Before your husband was nifted, who did it used to belong to? Again, these are normal conversations. She says, belong to both of us. That's the way people normally assume, belong to both of us. Okay. Yeah.
Repeat it, couldn't hear.
Repeat it. She said it used to belong to both of us. And therefore she now assumes it belongs just to her, and therefore she assumes that she can do whatever she wants with it. That's her assumption. Okay. So I said to her, listen, it could very well be it completely belongs to you. It could very, very well be. But it's probably worth finding out if it does belong to you completely. So I said, I'm going to assume for the moment it does, but I'll let you do a bit of homework. I'll try and do a bit of homework as well. And we'll be in touch. Right? Okay. I get a call a few days later from her son. And her son says to me, why do you have to misharai? I didn't misharai. I really didn't. But that was the question. Why do you have to misharai? He said it in a nice way, but that was essentially his question. Why do you have to mix in? He said, what I was hoping for is that she wouldn't put together a new will. And then everything would just go up the halacha, and I would end up with everything. That's what he said to me. Okay, the truth is, don't forget, he's doing nothing wrong over here.
Was he the only son?
We're gonna mix him, go through everything. By the way, please ask questions, but let's first get the clogging. So he basically said to me, I want to do whatever the Torah says. My father didn't write a will, and then my assumption is that my father would have wanted to follow whatever halacha says, which you can argue is a fair assumption. You can hear various tzedadim, but you can argue is a fair assumption. And therefore, he said, I want to go with whatever the halacha says. Fine? Okay. That's what he's saying. So it's going to be very, very clear now that it's not going to be so poshut that this mother is going to own the house. So what we now need to do is we need to work out what the mother does actually own, what she has control of, in order to understand what she can do. Okay, so now let's go through the actual facts. based on, we need to work out, number one, the fact of their case, and we also need to work out the fact of the halacha. Okay, so we're going to start off with the halacha, and then we'll go to the fact of this case. Both, we need to understand the English law properly as well, regarding the way that they own the house, and Hashem will discuss that, and then we'll apply it to the halacha, and then we'll discuss what maybe should have been done in order to get around this. Just like this. The halacha is...
She doesn't yashin.
What's that?
She doesn't yashin a husband.
Yeah, so we'll see. She doesn't. Halachically, she shouldn't.
Oh, no.
So let's go through it. So the halacha is that the halachas of Yerusha, the kids are the following. If the person passes away, then the halacha is the only people that inherit are the children. If there's no sons, the daughters will inherit. If there are sons, then only the sons will inherit. The daughters will not inherit at all. Now, if the daughters are not yet married, then there'll be a certain amount who ought to marry them off. But essentially, the sons are the only ones that inherit. We're also all familiar, I think, with the halacha of Pishanayim. In fact, I found people are more familiar with the din of Pishanayim, that the Bukhari gets double, than the din that sons inherit. Often people say to me, we've got no issues of halacha, we don't have to get around halacha, because we've got no Bukhari. Even though they may have five sons and five daughters. They don't realize, as long as there's a son there, then the son will be the only one that inherits.
Deceased son as well.
What was that?
A deceased son as well.
The deceased, yeah, whoever passes away, their
son. No, the son is no longer alive. To their children.
Yeah. Goes through the line.
So I found out that this piece now is only if the son was a point of Rechem. You're
100% right. 100% right. 100% right. He said that the whole din of Pishanayim, of double portion going to the Bukhari, only applies if the child's not a cesarean. Okay, fine. So that is the basic halacha. Now what about the wife? The man passes away with leaving a wife. Then the halacha is that the wife doesn't actually inherit. She's not halachic yerush, but she will be supported. She has to be supported from the estate. That means the sons inherit, but the sons have to allow her to be able to have shelter, to give her food, basically what we might call common sense. But they have to make sure that she's looked after. Until when?
Until
she's tover her kesuvah, until she claims a kesuvah, or she actually physically gets remarried. For the record, how much is a kesuvah nowadays?
About £3,000, huh?
Yeah, it's quite a range. It ranges between about £2,000 to about £20,000. And now those that say no, it's not a fixed amount. Rather, it's amount that it takes for a person to be supported for a year. Which, okay.
Does she have to? Does she have to tevea?
One second. And the idea is that she should be supported according to her old lifestyle. So what was the question? What was the question?
Does she have to convey, or do the children say, here's your money, kusuba, bye-bye?
They can't do that. They can't, so that'd be fantastic, right? They can't just go to her with a couple of grand and say, we'll make like that chitter, and then off you go. It's only when she's tevea. Basically, when she's tevea, what she's essentially doing is, she's severing her old relationship, essentially, and she's moving on.
To the next one.
Right? And she's moving on to the next one. So that's either done by being tevea, or by actually physically getting remarried. Just one more point, just again regarding the basics of Yerusha. The whole din of Pishanayim does not apply when a wife passes away. The din of Pishanayim is only when the husband, when the man passes away. When the wife passes away, then if the husband's still alive, it goes to him. If not, it goes to the sons equally, but there's no Pishanayim there. What's that? We're going to discuss how she can get hold of the money. He's right, how could she ever have money? But we're going to discuss ways in which you can get hold of the money. Okay, so let's go back to our story over here. And we've got the case of this almana, and she wants to know what she owns, right? She wants to leave the assets in a certain fashion, and we're telling her, it's not so posh and you own anything. Okay, so she says to me that her and her husband used to own the house together. Again, that's like this very fluffy expression, together. Everyone assumes they own a house together, right? That's what you assume. A husband and wife are married, they own the house together. That's what everyone assumes. The question is, what does it mean? So The answer is like this. The answer is like this. Very, very interesting. Very, very interesting. Avad on avad. Let's take it step by step. Avad on avad. If the husband owned the house himself, it was in his sole name, and it means on the land registry, all it says is Mr. Smith, then avada, it will be the sons that inherit it. In this particular scenario, there was two sons. In this fictional scenario, there was two sons. There's a bechor, and there was another son. And therefore, what should have happened was, is the bechor will take two-thirds, the other son will take a third, and they can do whatever they want with it. Again, as long as the mother's alive, she's got a right to live there. Right? They have to allow her to live there, but essentially it's theirs. That means that they can do whatever they want with it when she passes away. However, let me just finish off this point. However, over here, Itaka was owned jointly. Itaka was owned jointly. Mm-hmm. It was put in both names. Now, what a lot of people don't know is the following, that there are two ways of owning a house jointly, which has tremendous halachic ramifications. It's got legal ramifications, but it's also got tremendous halachic ramifications. A person can own a house jointly with someone else as something called joint tenants, or as something called tenants in common. Now people think, jointly, right? And if you look on the land registry, it looks exactly the same. But you'll see later on, there's a little line which describes whether it's held as joint tenants or tenants in common. What's the chilek between them? The chilek is, there's different types of shutfas. There's different types of shutfas. Joint tenants means that each of those owners of the house own the house 100%. Now, how can that be? It sounds like 200%. What does it mean? What it means is that if one passes away, the other one has already owned it. So let's say you've got Mr. and Mrs. Smith. They own a house as joint tenants together. And Mr. Smith decides that he's going to leave his half of the house. He thinks he owns half of the house. That's what you assume. He's going to leave his half of his house to, I don't know, to adopt him. He's not able to. However many documents he puts together, as long as they own it, as I said, as a joint tenant, he can't give it to someone else. Because she owns 100%, just like he owns 100%. And therefore, when he passes away, she will inherit it, whatever happens. She doesn't even really inherit it, if you think about it. It was always hers. Okay. So when this woman tells me that she owns it, she owned the house jointly with her husband, let's call her Mrs. Smith, and she says, Mr. Smith passed away 5 years ago. I thought, gevaldik, because halachically as well, I've discussed this with Diana in the past, halachically as well, if they own it as joint tenants, even though there's a din yerusha, that the wife won't inherit the husband, if they own it as joint tenants, then she owned 100% already mechayev. So when he passes away, it is hers because it was always hers. So I thought, gevaldik, she tells me that they own it jointly, no problem. She should own it, and even if the son titles, he wants to yarshan halachically, it's not his. So I checked up, and for some reason or other, they held it as tenants in common. Now, what's tenants in common? It's a different type of shutfas. It means that each one actually owns 50%. And each one has the full rights over their 50%, and they can give their chiluk to whoever they want. And based on this, the Yerusha will be chal. The Yerusha will be chal. Because she never owned more than 50% while he was alive. He owned his 50% completely, she owned her 50% completely. He passes away, it's going to fall to his Yorushim. His half will fall to his Yorushim. She'll still own her chelik 100%, so her 50% she'll own it completely. But his chelik will fall al pi Yerusha, and that taka was the case. So what happens in this situation? What happens in this situation regarding the house? We'll move it to the other asset soon. In this situation, and this was technically Paskin, I didn't Paskin it. I said, I think this is the situation that was confirmed with one of the Donim, that she will still own
50%.
Regarding his chelek, there'll be Pishnayim to Rovi. And there'll be one chelek to Shim. So this woman's now living in a house which is now split up into, the ownership split up into six. She owns 3/6. The Bechor Rubin owns 2/6. And Shimon owns 1/6. And that's what the boys wanted. Okay, let's move on now. So that is regarding the property.
All she does is 50-50.
What was that?
All she does will be 50-50 between the boys.
Once she dies, then
no peace.
A little bit of a mess. But the truth is, the ideal situation would have been at that point.
To actually
arrange everything properly, that you know, to move part of the house into the kitchen, etc. That would be the ideal thing to do. That's what should be done. That half of the house should then be put into the kids' names, right? As it is. And half should be hers, and then they can do what they want with their chalom. But the mice, that would be the halachic ownership, right? 3-6, 2-6, 1-6. What about the bank accounts? What about the bank accounts? This gets very interesting. So again, if we're talking about it was or the bank accounts were in his sole name, then it would go up your halacha. Was it his sole name in the bank accounts? He passed away, it goes up your halacha. But what would the halacha dictate? Let's say there's this bank account got, let's give it an easy number. Let's say it's got £99,000 in it. 100 gets complicated. Let's say it's got £99,000 in the bank account. So what do they think? And it was only in his name. Who should it go to and in what shares?
Children.
There's two children.
Children.
How much should I get? No. Any anyway.
Is there
6,000?
That's what I think, right? Lechera, 66 should go to Ruvain, and 33 should go to Shimon. However, Misht as a poshet.
It's not.
Misht as a poshet at all.
It's not ready cash.
That's the one. That's the shares, exactly. So we know there's a halacha that the Bechor gets Pishnaim. However, the Bechor gets Pishnaim in ha?
Mochzik.
Tell the answer. Not min haroi, not through that which is going to come in the future. Now what does this mean? What does this mean, Lukodian? What does this mean, definitely? What does it mean, that which, again, we say that the Reuven will get Pishnaim with whatever Yaakov, let's say his father, actually had when he passed away. Because he didn't have it, rather he was expecting it to come, then that's not, that he doesn't get Pishnaim. So a Poshet case which everyone agrees with the following. Yaakov lends Bob £10,000 cash. And then Yaakov passes away on Sunday. During the Shiva, Bob comes in on Wednesday and says to the kids, here's a bag of £10,000 cash, and I borrowed it from your father, and I'm now paying it. On that, there's no Din Mishnah. No Din Mishnah. Because when he passed away, he didn't actually have it. It was owed, it was right, it was befitting, it was going to come, we didn't actually have it. That's klosh. If Bob would have paid it up on Friday before he passed away, it's more so, it would have been Pishnaim. The shine in the poskim though is how do we look at a bank? So most of us think of a bank essentially as a safety deposit box. That's essentially how we think about banks, right? I put it in the bank and then I take it back out. That's how we think about it. But in reality, we know that's not actually how it works. In reality, they use the money, so to speak, and it gives a certain interest every so often. Not very much, but they give us a little bit of interest every so often. And then when we want it back, we tovei it back and they give us some other money. But it's not that same money. And therefore there's a discussion in the poskim whether the money in the bank is considered to be muhsuk, it's considered to be I've got it in my hands, or it's considered roi. Again, just to clarify something. If I did put cash in a safety deposit box, let's say some Swiss big vault, and I just stashed away loads of cash there,
that's cash.
Then that's mochsuk, and there'll be a din of pishnaim. Regarding money in the bank, Ramosha seems to say in Shuba that it's considered to be ro'oi and not mochsuk. He seems to say, although I have heard from others that he did say at another time that it's considered to be mochsuk. But Ramosha does seem to say in Shuba that it's considered ro'oi. It is a machleks aposkim what the status of a bank account is. So, okay, so what do we have over here in this situation? So again, sorry, one more time. But that's all if the husband owned it. So it was only the husband. If it was, however, a joint bank account, then joint bank accounts are always like what we said, joint tenants. Always like with property, we mentioned joint tenants. Bank accounts are pretty much always like that. And then if one passes away, the other one will take it completely. For the record, people need to know that having a bank account jointly with a child, some people make arrangements. They want to make sure that the child can help them out. So they think, you know, we'll do a Hamish arrangement. We'll do a joint bank account, and my child will be able to have access because it's a joint account. You should know if you do that, the child will inherit automatically. Okay, there's other ways of doing it. If it's just a regular joint bank account, parent together the child, in order the child can have access, the child will inherit whatever you write in your will. There's other ways of doing it. You can have your bank account, but you arrange with the bank that the child can have access. You can do a power of attorney, or you can just have a chat with the bank, they might give access. But a joint bank account, it's important to know that whatever you write in your will, it won't help. Okay. Sorry?
Dan told me, and Dan Gunner told me, that there's no such thing anymore, Pishnayim, that you give it extra Beth or something like that, and that's good enough for Pishnayim.
100% correct, but out of context. Let me explain. Avado and Avado, if there's no will, all the halachas of the Torah will take effect. All the halachas will take effect. Now, whether the children want to sort of shtel zu, so to speak, to the sisters and give a little bit, that's something else. What you're referring to is, what you're referring to is what is our level of responsibility? Meaning, if when we write a will, do we have to leave it all up to Torah? Or can we, you know, change it around a bit and maybe give the girls an equal portion? In that, the post can say, in fact, let's move on. So again, you know, let me just summarize what we said, and then we'll move on to that point, and then we'll finish up with that point, because that's really the lemaisa. So again, regarding this particular situation with this woman, the bottom line was, because of the way everything was held, then the property itself would be split into six, where half would go to the wife, two chalokim of the other half, two six would go to the bechor, and one six would go to the other son. Regarding the bank account, because it happened to be in this situation, it was jointly, it would go all to her. However, if it wasn't jointly, if it was all held in Yaakov's name, then it wouldn't have gone Pishnayim, because, assuming it's considered to be Roy and not Mukhsuk, rather it would have gone 50-50 amongst the children. Okay, so now the Maisa, how do we go about, if a person wants things to end up differently, he wants to make sure that it's all simple, and for example, he wants everything to go equally to the children, or all to the wife, depending on what the time is, then he has to write a will. Now this is where Mr. Spielman's point comes in, like this. How can a person go against the Torah? The Torah says not like that. The Torah's got a completely different method of distribution. And the person wants to write a will, saying, you know, that's a standard will. Everything goes to my wife. If not, I want everything to go to my children. How can you do that? The answer is there's a tashbits. Other places as well, but it's often quoted in the name of the tashbits. The tashbits says that as long as you leave, what's this expression? Four zuz or something like that, a certain amount of money, which is going to be distributed purely al pi Torah, then the rest of the estate you can write however you want. Now that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be binding and based in. That's very, very important. Just because you've written in your will, for example, I want everything to go to my children equally, and I'm leaving a certain amount just up in Torah, that doesn't necessarily make it that it's going to be binding up your based in. It just means you haven't gone against the Torah. Now, what is this significant amount you need to leave according to the Torah mandated distribution? It needs to be something significant. What's considered to be significant? So Moshe in one teshuva seems to say that $1,000 is good enough. It's a very interesting teshuva. He was asked by someone whose covenant children had gone off and the others had plenty of money themselves, and he basically wanted to give only $1,000 to his sons and the rest he wanted to give elsewhere. And Moshe said, it's fine. He said $1,000 is good enough, right, for this small amount. And what a lot of poskim talk about, not poskim, but dayanim that I've spoken to, what they talk about is leaving just the svarim al pi halacha, right? Just the svarim. They say the svarim will go al pi halacha. That means they'll say everything besides the svarim will go equally. For example, the svarim. So let's talk about our case with Reuven and Shimon. Regarding the svarim, then Reuven will get two halachim and Shimon will get one chiluk. Or like you mentioned bechas, yeah. So bechas is also a very popular one. Also, you could do it regarding Bechas. Why Bechas? What way is that significant? Because it's sentimentally significant. Right? It's sentimentally significant. It's something which has been used every week. For the record, the Mile of Svarim, I think, the Mile of Svarim is that if someone's got a Svarim collection And the Svarim collection are in his dining room and across the whole wall. It's going to be very hard to argue that's not considered significant. This is like his, this is what he's showing off to the world, right? So well, that would certainly be considered to be significant. So let's just, quite late, started a bit late, so just, I'll just go a couple of minutes over. But again, we have not yet discussed at all this time about how to make the will binding and basic. However, if a person does write a will, and everything, and sorry, and there's one part of the will which is complying completely with the Torah mandated distribution, leaves the Sfarim up Yalacha, leaves a significant amount of money up Yalacha, leaves maybe the Bechas up Yalacha. By the way, $1,000, that was in 1966, I think it was. I wrote it in my notes when it was. I think it was Tavshin Chafav. Tavshin Chafav is 1966.
That's 5,000 nowadays.
Was that?
5,000.
Exact more, probably much more than 5,000.
Or more, a house, right? In those days, you could get a house for about 3,000.
Exactly. So he didn't say that $1,000 is the minimum. His shaila was, back then, was, is $1,000 good enough? He said, yeah, that's fine. It could be, it would be less, but definitely $1,000. 1966, today will probably be, I don't know, 10, 15, 20?
More.
Okay, a lot. Depends on what you're based on. Okay, so therefore, if a person does that, who would be going to be in halacha? Now, the only question is, which we're not going to discuss today, but just to touch on it, is, okay, so a person's put together a will, and he's also made sure that it doesn't go against halacha, because he's followed the tashbeit. He said that a certain amount should be left apidin Torah. That is, I'd say, 95% of the way. And if a person's done that, he should have definitely a large level of menuchas nefesh. And for most people, that'll be fine as well. There isn't really much to worry about after that. The only thing is, a person should know that although such a will, you're not going against halacha, you're complying with halacha. Well, I like to put it, you've ticked the halachic box, and you've also made a will which says how you want everything to be distributed. There are some batei din, that would not honour such a will in their basting. They would say it's not binding. There are many Botiyadin that would say it is binding. Without going into it, Rav Padva has got a fascinating teshuva. Malich Dushim, Rav Padva, in Cheshav Eifoit.
Oh, that's it.
In Cheshav Eifoit.
The ex-Rod.
Yeah. Cheshav Eifoit. He's got a fascinating teshuva to explain how our wills with executors, that means people who are appointed to be able to deal with all the assets, Lachmei of Esrim, our wills would be binding and based in. I've added together with the Tashbit, together with leaving a certain amount of point halacha, he says they are binding and based in. But there are many dayanim that say that they will not be binding and based in. So there are other things that can be done together with the secular will. There are other stories that can be considered to make sure there is binding in all batei din. So let's just summarize one more time. We've discussed the basic halachas of Yerusha. Again, the basic halachas are that everything goes to the children. Everything goes to the children. If it's from the father, then there'll be pishanayim to the sons. To the bechor, and then one chilek to all of the other sons. If there's any unmarried daughters, then they've got an achrayis to make sure that the daughters can get married. They've also got an achrayis to make sure that their mother can be sheltered. Have food according to her previous level of living. When the mother passes away, then as we mentioned, all goes, and if the husband's still around, it goes to the husband. If not, then it goes to the children, the sons equally. As I said, if a person gets his will sorted out, we're leaving by the tashbeit, leaving a certain amount, a significant amount. Okay, halacha, like I said, that's 95% of the way. For most people, that's enough. There is, as I said, though, the slight concern, just to bear in mind, that according to some of these, such a will will not be binding halacha. If sons are happy, are going to shell too, they're not going to argue with it, then there won't be an issue. Let's just finish off, though, with one vote. The Chavetz Chaim, I've seen the Babbage Shemarat, and the Babbage Shemarat writes about it. they say that the person arranges his affairs and it's a skull of yomim. So I don't think it's such a jump to say that discussing the halachas as well, discussing, trying to understand a bit better, could also be a skudas, but is Hashem, all the skudas should be included.